My name is Christopher Bryseth. I'm the president of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. And we are delighted to have you all here today at the National Press Club to join in this Four Freedoms Roundtable to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the Securities and Exchange Commission, one of the remarkable pieces of legislation developed during those early days of the New Deal under President Franklin Roosevelt. We are sponsored today in this lunch that helped to defray the costs by the Bernard and Audrey Rappaport Foundation in Waco, Texas. And we're particularly grateful to B. Rappaport for his support. The Roosevelt Institute is located in the Presidential Library, the FDR Presidential Library. We're very much aware of presidential libraries in this present period as we are in mourning for President Reagan. The center of his life in the last several years and now perpetually will be his resting place at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, just as the final resting place for FDR and Mrs. Roosevelt is at Hyde Park. This is the first of a series of Four Freedoms Roundtables by the Roosevelt Institute to put focus on the extraordinary presidential legacy of FDR. And we're joined in the sponsorship today by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, and you're going to hear in just a moment from their vice chair. I would like, before proceeding any further, to just have a moment of silence in memory and in honor of President Ronald Reagan. Thank you very much. I want to identify some of the folks who are here today. Among our Roosevelt Institute board members, past and present, if they would stand as I introduce them, but don't give them any applause, just see them, and at the end you may put your hands together. Alida Black, Don Fowler, Senator Sarbanes himself. Is Leslie Dunbar here yet? Philip Kaiser, and representing her father, Forrest Church, and the granddaughter of Senator Frank Church, Nina Church. Now you can applaud. Our partnership in Hyde Park with the FDR Library is also a partnership with the National Archives and Records Administration. And we have a particularly close relationship to the staff here in Washington. And delighted that we have with us today Sharon Fawcett, John Constance, Susan Cooper, Stacy Bredhoff, and Chris Smith. We welcome our friends from the National Archives. And as you all know, staff make the world go round in Washington and elsewhere. And I'd like to acknowledge Carla Rosati of the SEC's Historical Society, who is finishing a very creative week of commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the SEC. And our own staff from Hyde Park, David Wolner, Robert Bullock, and Elaine Murphy. I would now like, in calling on our partner from the SEC Historical Society, to introduce Richard Rowe, the Vice President of the Board of Trustees, to bring greetings.
Thank you, Christopher. I am Richard Rowe, a Vice President and Trustee of the SEC Historical Society. On behalf of my fellow trustees, I would like to welcome all of you that are present here, including former colleagues on the SEC staff, former SEC Commissioner Irving Pollack, and some of the SEC staff also here. I'd also like to welcome those of you who are listening in online on www.sechistorical.org. The Society is honored to partner with the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute with today's program on the SEC A New Era. The Society was founded as a nonprofit organization in 1999 to preserve and share the history and historic records of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry. We do so through our virtual museum at, as I have said before, www.sechistorical.org. Today's program will be archived and transcribed after broadcast and will be added to the museum's collection. We currently have more than 500 papers, photos, oral histories, and online programs in the museum. More than 750 persons each month visit the museum and use our collections. While the Society is independent of and separate from the SEC, we are taking the lead this year in commemorating the 70th anniversary of the founding of the SEC in 1934. Today's program is part of these commemorative activities. Our thanks again to the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute for giving the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society the opportunity to present today's program on the SEC A New Era online at, and I repeat again, www.sechistorical.org, and sharing it through our museum.
And I invite Dr. Cook, who's coming up in 30 seconds, to repeat her www also. Cynthia Cook and I have the constant challenge of differentiating our two organizations, which work in intimate partnership in Hyde Park and around the country. She's the director of the FDR Presidential Library, represents the National Archives in that very important assignment. I'm the president of the Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, which, among other things in its mission, is committed to perpetuating the legacy of FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt and to inspire the application of their spirit of optimism and innovation to the solution of current problems. So not only are we interested in commemorating an event like this one, but we're also looking for how we learn from that to apply those lessons to our present time. Dr. Cook is presiding over a tremendous amount of development at the FDR Presidential Library, including a new building that is named for Henry Wallace, the new visitor center. If you've not been to Hyde Park for a long time, I really urge you to come up and join us and to see what is happening there to interpret this legacy that is so important to the country. It is now my great pleasure to invite Dr. Cynthia Cook to bring her welcome.
Thank you, Chris. And I just appreciate very much the opportunity to speak to all of you as part of the ongoing effort to help people understand the Roosevelt legacy and its persistence as an important part of our daily lives every day. We at the Roosevelt Library operate a museum that serves about 100,000 visitors every year, school children, as well as families, adults, senior citizens. We also have the most actively used research room among the presidential libraries, with about 750 researchers coming to use our 17 million pages of archival documents. So I welcome all of you to come and do what Roosevelt wanted all of us to do when he built this first presidential library. And in dedicating it in 1941, he said, "A nation must believe in three things. It must believe in the past, it must believe in the present, but most of all, it must believe in the capacity of its people so to learn from the past in the creation of their future." That's our mission at the Roosevelt Library, and it's a mission that reaches out to all of you everywhere, and we invite you to come, whether it's by our website, www.fdrlibrary.marist.edu, or in person, which we would very much prefer. And before I leave, I have to always, when I address a group, I can't help but turn to some of the Roosevelt archives to have just a word that brings the president's words to us today. And so I looked back into his speeches and found a fireside chat from September 30th, 1934, at the conclusion of the round of legislation that created not only the SEC, but also the early reforms that set our financial status back on a road to health. And at the conclusion of that fireside chat, he said these words: "I am not for a return to that definition of liberty under which for so many years a free people were being gradually regimented into the service of the privileged few. I prefer, and I am sure you prefer, that a broader definition of liberty under which we are moving forward to greater freedom, to greater security for the average man than he has ever known before in the history of America." And for those words and in that spirit, I congratulate the SEC on its 70th anniversary. Thank you.
And now to introduce our honored guest today, the, if not the last of the New Dealers of the Senate, certainly one of the most dominant New Dealers in our present U.S. Senate, I turn to Judge Stanley Sporkin, a colleague of Senator Sarbanes, a partner at the Washington offices of Weil, Gottschall, and Mangus, graduate of the Yale Law School. Judge Sporkin has spent 20 years at the SEC, serving during his last 7 years as the director of the Division of Enforcement. He then served 5 years as general counsel to the CIA before former President Reagan appointed him to the federal bench, where he served as the United States District Judge for the District of Columbia for 14 years. He's been the recipient of numerous awards, but I would cite two: the President's Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service in 1979, the highest honor that can be granted to a member of the Federal Civil Career Service, and the 1994 William O. Douglas Award for Lifetime Achievement by the Association of the Securities and Exchange Commission Alumni. Ladies and gentlemen, Judge Stanley Sporkin.
Thank you. It's a great privilege. And before I begin, we're talking about the SEC today, and I see in the audience some of the SEC's real legends and greats, former Commissioner Pollack and Milton Kroll. These are people that were instrumental in getting the SEC the reputation that it now has and that it deserves. But it's a real privilege to have the opportunity to introduce Senator Paul Sarbanes, an outstanding American and great legislator. What is more, he's my senator. The senator has now spent almost 40 years in the public arena, serving his country and his state. He has been in the United States Senate since 1976, having been elected to the Senate on 5 occasions, the longest serving senator in the history of Maryland. Before that, he served 3 terms in the House of Representatives. He's the son of Greek immigrants who owned and operated the Mayflower Restaurant in Salisbury, Maryland. Senator Sarbanes made the most of the educational opportunities that had been provided to him by his hardworking parents and his outstanding academic and athletic achievements. What an academic record it is. He graduated from Princeton University in 1954. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and when he returned from England, enrolled at Harvard Law School, where he received his law degree in 1960. He then clerked for United States District Court Judge Morris Soffer, and after a short time in private practice, began his long career in public service. The good senator has been married to his wife of some 47 years, the former Christine Dunbar, a teacher of Latin and classical Greek, whom he met during his Rhodes Scholarship days in London. Senator Sarbanes and Christine are the parents of 3 children, and he's the grandparents of 5 children. As we celebrate the 70th anniversary of the SEC, an agency that history has already found to be one of the crowning achievements of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt era. It is indeed fitting that Paul Sarbanes has been asked to make this commemorative address. All of us who have been in the service of the Securities and Exchange Commission are well aware of the landmark legislation of that era, the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, with its crowning achievement of creating the Securities and Exchange Commission. Once an instrumentality of government has reached its maturity, it oftentimes loses its enthusiasm and indeed on occasion becomes the captive of those it regulates. I am pleased to report, as I am sure many in the business world would agree, the SEC is as robust today as it was when it was created and operated under the leadership of Joseph Kennedy, its first chairman. The times we live in often dictate colossal changes that ultimately result in historic movements. New legislation or amendments to existing laws are usually the driving force that brings about needed changes. The financial excesses of the 1920s and 1930s were the impetus for the Exchange Act and the establishment of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The original act, with only modest amendments over these past 70 years, has clearly stood the test of time. However, the catastrophic events in our financial markets over the past several years demonstrated some glaring weaknesses in the statute's original architecture. In steps, Senator Sarbanes, at the time chairman of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, before he and his outstanding staff put pen to paper, his committee held a series of hearings. These were not the explosive type of the Ferdinand Pecora era, where the purpose was to hold up to public ridicule those who contributed to the collapse of the financial markets of the day. Instead, the hearings were without flamboyance. Senator Sarbanes convened a number of panels comprised of leaders of the various groups that had intricate knowledge of the way our financial markets work. Based upon this testimony, the committee's outstanding staff began to write new legislation that was specifically directed at fixing the problems that were being exposed on a daily basis. The legislation emanated from this careful and thoughtful process, which later was merged with Congressman Oxley's House legislation, ranks with the finest legislation that has been produced by the Congress during this past century. Clearly, Sarbanes-Oxley is the most important securities legislation since the creation of the SEC 70 years ago. The legislation is so comprehensive and far-reaching that it is difficult to describe it in a few brief paragraphs. The one recurring theme seems to be the establishment of a variety of gatekeepers. The Act takes account that there are a number of persons in the process of running and overseeing the operations of our public corporations who must be held accountable for the public corporation's compliance with law. Accordingly, a major part of the legislation requires corporate management and corporate directors to assure that their corporations conduct themselves in compliance with law. It also holds accountable those persons that provide services to public corporations. Thus, the legal and accounting professions are now also held to account when they do not operate in the shareholders' best interest. Indeed, I believe in time the Act will eventually become known as the Lawyers and Accountants Emancipation Act. This is because, under the statute, a lawyer now clearly knows who he or she is the lawyer for, which is the corporation, and not beholden to the CEO or other member of management. Similarly, accountants now are retained by the corporation's audit committee and must meet the standards set by the new Accounting Oversight Board. They must act in the best interests of the corporation and not on behalf of a management that may have interests different from those of the shareholders. In my view, with continued vigilance on the part of the SEC and with the corporate community getting it, Sarbanes-Oxley will have performed an important and necessary service for investors and the nation's financial stability. I'm therefore very pleased to introduce the chief architect of the legislation, and we should all be proud to be served by a senator of such absolute brilliance, wisdom, and integrity, an individual who has always dedicated himself to the service of the citizens of this nation. I now, with great pride, give you Senator Sarbanes.
Stanley, thank you for an extraordinarily generous introduction. I deeply appreciate it. Stanley Sporkin, of course, was a legend in his own time at the SEC, as we all well know, as the head of the Division of Enforcement. And in fact, as it was mentioned in the introduction of him, received the distinguished the President's Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service. That's the highest honor that can be granted to any member of the federal career service, and it was certainly well justified and well warranted. I appreciate Stanley's making reference to my immigrant parents who ran a restaurant. I worked in that restaurant all through my youth, so I urge you to go on eating your lunch. I'm used to working while people are eating. part of my upbringing. And he also made reference, and I have to divert on this for a moment, that I'm now the longest serving senator in Maryland's history, now in my fifth term. It's a little bit like Cal Ripken. Every day you go to work, you set a new record, you see. It's always one day longer than the day before. I'm very pleased to be here. Today's discussion, of course, is a collaborative effort on the part of the SEC Historical Society and the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. Though different in focus, these two institutions have much in common. Both are major repositories of significant primary source material in their respective fields. Their reach extends far beyond scholars to practitioners, and indeed, through a variety of programs, to the general public. And I think they're guided by the fundamental proposition that knowledge and understanding of the past is essential to confronting the problems of the present and to enlighten planning for the future. In fact, the head of the Roosevelt Library made that very point just a few minutes ago here at the podium. Now, in the interest of full and timely disclosure, although Chris Bryseth already took care of this, let me say at the outset that I serve on the Board of Governors of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. And since disclosure was so much a part of our legislation, I think it's very important to lay it out here. Most of the functions of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute heretofore have taken place at Hyde Park in New York City and indeed at the Roosevelt Study Center in the Netherlands. So it's a special pleasure to welcome the Institute to Washington, and we hope this will set a pattern for the future. This is an especially propitious time because of the events of the last several weeks make clear just how significant the Roosevelt legacy is and how deeply embedded it is in our national life. And I'll come back to talk about the SEC anniversary, but I'm thinking of other major events. First, the death of former President Ronald Reagan brings to mind his respect for the Roosevelt legacy, which he always reflected in his comments, and his optimistic outlook for America, which of course paralleled Roosevelt's boundless faith and optimism in his fellow Americans. President Roosevelt rallied the courage of the American people in a time of crisis of a magnitude without parallel in our lifetime. The Roosevelt legacy is also with us as we mark the 60th anniversary of D-Day and the dedication of the World War II Memorial. President Roosevelt is remembered as a great war president, but he was also deeply committed not only to winning the war, but to establishing the international institutions to keep the peace thereafter. Barely 2 months after the Normandy invasion, a full year before the war finally ended, the Allied powers met here in Washington under U.S. leadership to set out broad principles for international cooperation and to lay the foundation for the United Nations. There was no imperative for the United States to do this. We were incontestably at the time the world's only superpower. the only country that would emerge from the war with its economic, industrial, and social infrastructure intact. Yet in those post-war years, the United States very deliberately did not pursue its interests abroad through the unilateral exercise of its overwhelming military and economic advantages. Instead, we set out on a very different policy path, seeking to advance our national interests wherever possible through a broad international consensus. It was President Roosevelt who put us on that path. The Securities and Exchange Commission is yet another legacy of the Roosevelt era, in its own sphere, very far-reaching. It represented the government's determination to guarantee to investors the integrity of the capital markets, which had been so egregiously violated and with such catastrophic losses to investors. It changed fundamentally the operation of those markets. The creation of the commission was, in fact, the second step toward that goal, the first being the comprehensive disclosure requirements. In his first famous inaugural address, President Roosevelt set out what he called the lines of attack needed to end the crisis. Prominent among them was strict supervision of all banking and credit and investments. And within a month, he recommended to the Congress legislation for federal supervision of traffic and investment securities in interstate commerce. The proposal was carefully designed to protect the public with the least possible interference to honest business. His message to the Congress of March 29, 1933, read in part, "This proposal adds to the ancient rule of caveat emptor, the further doctrine, let the seller also beware. It puts the burden of telling the whole truth on the seller. It should give impetus to honest dealing in securities and thereby bring back public confidence." The 1933 Securities Act, also known as Truth in Securities, was signed into law on May 27. Barely a year later, on June 6, 1934, literally within 2 days, 70 years ago, the President signed the Securities Exchange Act into law, thereby establishing the SEC. The acts were drafted by some of the best legal minds in the country. The unlikely trio of Jim Landis, Ben Cohn, and Tommy Corcoran. All former students of Felix Frankfurter's at the Harvard Law School, they were chosen by Frankfurter and proceeded with their work under his guidance. At the time, critics were warning that the legislation would have a negative impact on the workings of our economic system. But as Arthur Schlesinger has noted, in fact, the legislation had a very positive effect on the markets. And I quote Arthur Schlesinger when he says, "Far from destroying the securities business, the laws were offering it a new lease on life. It was not only that they gave disillusioned investors new reasons for confidence. Even more, they removed the whole process of capital investment from the realm of guess and gamble and rested it through the detailed and continuous disclosure required by the SEC on the basis of reliable fact." In certain ways, the situation we have confronted in recent years is comparable to the crisis of 70 years ago. As the Wall Street Journal put it, quote, the scope and scale of the corporate transgressions of the late 1990s now coming to light exceed anything the U.S. has witnessed since the years preceding the Great Depression. Think back just 3 years ago. In June of 2001, I became chairman of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. All hail to Vermont, and a thank you to Jim Jeffords, if I may be permitted to say so. At the time I became the chairman, Enron was the nation's seventh largest company. For the first quarter of 2001, Enron had reported a 20% increase in profits over the previous quarter. For the second quarter, they reported a further 40% increase over the first quarter. By the fall, near the end of the year, Enron was in bankruptcy, the largest bankruptcy in the nation's history until WorldCom some 6 months later. Enron was, in fact, the canary in the mine shaft. A number of major, highly regarded public companies, along with their auditors, were relying upon convoluted and often fraudulent accounting devices to inflate earnings, hide losses, and drive up stock prices. News stories and headlines announced new disclosures almost on a daily basis. If you can't believe the auditors, who can you believe? Business Week. System failure. Corporate America has lost its way. Fortune magazine. And Fortune went on to say, phony earnings, inflated revenues, conflicted Wall Street analysts, directors asleep at the switch. This isn't just a few bad apples we're talking about here. This, my friends, is a systemic breakdown. Money magazine subsequently reached the same conclusion. The failure to recognize the warning signals indicated, the magazine said, a total failure by everyone, a complete breakdown in the system, in all the checks and balances. Over a period of months, market values fell by some trillions of dollars. Thousands of jobs were lost. Retirement savings dried up. What we faced in the capital markets was not a ripple, but a tidal wave, and with it a crisis in investor confidence. We had to determine how to proceed in the committee, and as Stanley Sporkin indicated, we undertook to hold a very intense set of hearings, in a sense to do it the old-fashioned way, in a very substantive examination of what the problems were and what the solutions ought to be. And so over close to a two-month period in early 2002, we set out to identify the problems and particularly to examine whether there were systemic and structural flaws in the framework in which the markets were operating that needed to be corrected. There were some, of course, at the time who said, well, just punish the bad apples, and that alone will be sufficient to bring the situation under control. I thought one extreme example of that was the Secretary of the Treasury at the time. They asked him, well, what do you think should be done? He said, well, these malefactors ought to be taken out and hung from the nearest tree. I thought that was a little short and weak on due process. So we undertook to do these hearings to see, you know, really what was the problem, what we ought to do. We received testimony from close to 40 witnesses in 10 hearings, all deeply knowledgeable about the markets, many with long and distinguished experience in both the public and the private sector. In fact, we started off with a panel with the five former chairmen of the SEC at the table, appointed by both Democratic and Republican presidents. They gave terrific testimony, and we moved on through. Some of the hearings were enormously technical and complicated. In fact, we had one hearing with the three former chief accountants of the SEC at the table. And at one point in the hearing, one of my colleagues, not realizing his microphone was on, says, phew, this is really boring. With all due respect to the chief accountants of the SEC, past, present, and future, I have to say he was right. It was heavy going. But at that point, my colleague, Republican Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming, who was sitting over here, he's the only CPA in the United States Senate of the 100 members. Enzi is the only CPA. So when this colleague made this comment about how boring it was, Enzi, which is not like him, sort of leaped into the discussion, and he says, "It may be boring to you, but I haven't had this much fun since I came to the United States Senate." The hearings actually produced a remarkable consensus on the nature of the problem. Inadequate oversight of accountants, the lack of auditor independence, weak corporate governance procedures, a stock analyst conflicts of interest. They were telling their clients to buy a stock and sending emails to one another saying what a dog the stock was. Inadequate disclosure provisions. Ken Lay was telling the employees of Enron in the fall of 2001 to buy the company's stock because it was a good investment. And at the very same time, he was selling his stock. A grossly inadequate funding of the Securities and Exchange Commission, an issue which had worried a number of us for quite a substantial period of time. This is very briefly is what the legislation sought to do. To establish effective accounting oversight, industry self-regulation had failed to meet the criterion of independence stipulated in the Securities Acts and spelled out by the Supreme Court in the Arthur Young decision, where the court said, and I quote them, "By certifying the public reports that collectively depict a corporation's financial status, the independent auditor assumes a public responsibility transcending any employment relationship with the client. This public watchdog function demands that the accountant maintain total independence from the client at all times and requires complete fidelity to the public trust." The legislation assigns now, it creates a new body, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, to exercise regulatory responsibility. All accounting firms that audit public companies must register with the board, which has the authority to set auditing standards, to investigate, and where necessary, to impose penalties. Both the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and the pre-existing Financial Accounting Standards Board, which sets the accounting standards, are now to be funded by mandatory fees on public companies so that their budget will, in effect, be guaranteed. The FASB was going around seeking voluntary contributions from the very interests with respect to whom they were about to promulgate standards, and were often told, well, if you go in that direction, you're not going to get any contributions from us. The legislation requires auditor independence. If you're the auditor of a public company, there are certain consulting services you can't engage in. That was in part a recognition of the shift of the revenues away from core auditing and accounting to management consulting. In 1977, 70% of the revenues were from core auditing and accounting. By 1998, it had fallen to about a third, and management advisory, which had been at 12%, rose to over 50%. So you had the auditors getting these management contracts from the management of the company, which of course led to serious questions about how hard-hitting they would be on their audit. It sets standards for corporate governance. Public companies must have audit committees independent of management. Auditors are hired and fired to report to the audit committees. CEOs and CFOs are required to vouch directly for the accuracy of their company's financial statements. It requires numerous disclosures, including prompt disclosure of trades in company stock by insiders, disclosure of material off-balance sheet transactions. It seeks to address analyst conflict of interest by requiring the SEC and the exchanges to adopt rules and sustain the independence of the analysts. And, of course, we went ahead and authorized SEC funding at a level that will enable the commission to hire additional accountants and attorneys and improve its technology infrastructure. These resources were urgently needed. They were long overdue. The market activity expanded much faster than the commission's capacity to conduct effective oversight. The staff was underpaid, overworked. The annual turnover rate was 1 in 3. And over the last 4-year period, we have succeeded in just about doubling the SEC budget, and to the administration's credit, they have submitted those requests to the Congress to see that increase in the resources of the SEC. Very quickly, since the law became effective 2 years ago, what's been accomplished? Well, I think we have a newly invigorated SEC under the steady and determined leadership of Chairman Donaldson and his fellow commissioners. The commission had taken a hit to its internal morale and external stature. I think the chairman has closed that chapter and opened a new one. Morale is improving, enforcement is strong, rulemaking is rigorous. The commission is now getting a budget that they can really work with, enable them to meet their responsibilities. The Public Company Accounting Oversight Board is up and going. This is a major accomplishment on the part of the SEC, which was responsible for setting it up from scratch. And Chairman Donaldson was able to get Bill McDonough, the former head of the New York Federal Reserve, to assume the chairmanship, and he and his four fellow members of the board, extremely able people, now have opened offices in Washington, New York, San Francisco, Dallas. They're hiring auditors at high levels of experience. It has its inspection procedures in place, and in fact, inspections will be fully phased in this month. The SEC is also moving ahead to implement other aspects of the legislation, accelerated disclosure requirements for insiders, promulgated rules on attorney conduct. It's approved SRO-enacted rules to raise listing standards, prevent analyst conflicts of interest. It cooperated with the New York Attorney General and other state attorney generals in the global settlement. All of this builds on the legislation of 70 and 71 years ago. These acts remain the bedrock. As the Economist has said about them, the creation of a cop on the corner of Wall Street in the shape of the Securities and Exchange Commission proved to be a masterstroke. The SROs have undertaken profound changes in their own governance procedures. When the New York Stock Exchange was required to address governance practices of its listed companies, it had to assess its own practices. And of course, we're seeing very extensive changes taking place at the stock exchange. The Conference Board's Commission on Public Trust and Private Enterprise, co-chaired by Pete Peterson, former Secretary of Commerce, and John Snow before he became the Treasury Secretary, has set out first-rate best practices principles. We held an oversight hearing back in the fall in which Pete Peterson testified, I sense a sea change in attitude toward corporate governance practices to implement better governance. I've never seen board of directors and CEOs as diligent and as proactively involved as they are today on achieving governance improvements. And nevertheless, the SEC will continue to confront for some time the deep-seated problems of accounting, auditing, and corporate governance that have taken such a heavy toll on our markets in recent years. Those issues are by no means fully behind us. The mutual fund industry remains a matter of concern. The industry went largely unscrutinized as the Congress moved toward reform legislation to address abuses in accounting, auditing, and corporate governance. In fact, as recently as March of 2003, the chairman of the Investment Company Institute said in testimony to a House committee, and I quote, "The comprehensive regulatory scheme under which mutual funds operate has served the interest of fund investors well and kept the industry free of the types of problems that have surfaced in other businesses in the recent past." Since then, a litany of abuses has come to light, all of them at the expense of investors. While many proposed rules are pending now in the SEC to address not only the mutual fund, but corporate governance, hedge funds, the New York Times reports that the commission has come under intense pressure to water down proposed rule changes in the way corporate boards are elected, mutual funds are governed, and hedge funds are regulated. the proposals have provoked intense lobbying on several fronts. Yet just 2 days ago, in an issue devoted entirely to money, 2004, the moral quandaries, the Sunday New York Times magazine featured a series of articles on questions arising from the experience of recent years, on corporate fraud, the utility of tough criminal sanctions, on investors' greed. Among these sorry accounts, and we need to constantly bear this in mind, there was one entitled Fraud's Fallout on the Human Costs. It profiled in stark terms several of the 17,000 WorldCom employees who lost their jobs at the time of the company's collapse. We cannot leave the job half done. The experience of the past several years makes clear that our capital markets will not function effectively unless the investors are fully confident of the market's integrity and transparency. Furthermore, we need to keep in mind the fact that the reputation of the American capital markets for integrity, honesty, transparency has always been an important economic asset of this country. Our capital markets, our capital markets are a major economic asset for the nation in terms of its economic strength. The challenge is not just to clean up recent scandals, but to create a solid framework for the future. In carrying out its responsibilities, the SEC is fortunate to have men and women of uncommon dedication and competence who have built its standing as a crown jewel among federal regulatory agencies. We're privileged that some are here with us today, Stanley Sporkin, Irving Pollack, Milton Kroll, and others who have served the commission so brilliantly in the past. As for the future, I have confidence that this tradition will continue, in part because the commission had the good sense to hire away one of our young staffers from our banking committee who's gone over to the commission. We expect great things from him. Let me close by noting that our federal securities laws were enacted 70 years ago so that the experience of the years preceding the Great Depression would never be repeated. They have worked extraordinarily well. As originally drafted, however, they did not reach to recent rapid changes in the markets, conditions that could not have been anticipated at the time. We have acted to adjust the framework to encompass today's requirements. We must restore honest, transparent, ethical business practices and the safety mechanisms to keep them in place. Most people are honest, but the bad actors can tarnish everyone. Bill Donaldson, the chairman of the SEC, spoke to these points in a speech here at the National Press Club last July 30th on the first anniversary of the enactment of the reform legislation. He rejected suggestions, including in the press, that the recent crackdown on corporations and executives by criminal and civil authorities, including the commission, had discouraged honest risk-taking. On the contrary, he observed, Sarbanes-Oxley and the other steps that have accompanied it will lead to an environment where honest business and honest risk-taking will be encouraged and rewarded. And he went on to say, successful corporate leaders must strive to do the right thing in disclosure, in governance, and otherwise in their business. And they must instill in their corporations this attitude of doing the right thing. Simply complying with the rules is not enough. They should make this approach part of their company's DNA. It's this approach in the past that has made our markets the envy of the world. In this new era, the Commission will be called upon to reaffirm and again the same principles that have guided its work from the very beginning, 70 years ago. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions. We did pass out some cards to write them down. Maybe if we've got one question to begin with, I would say, Senator Sarbanes, that it was characteristic of you that until you quoted the very end, you never referred to the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, which is the name it will carry, in ways that even the SEC legislation does not carry a name. So to that, we are both want to recognize your contribution to this great federal legislative tradition. Now, do we have a question, or has the senator solved it all?
Okay. While someone's conjuring up a question, not that this group needs to let me just say there's one burden that comes with this naming, Sarbanes-Oxley. Oxley in Ohio has people wondering why he changed his first name to Sarbanes. And I have people in Maryland who are wondering why I'm running around now with this hyphenated last name. You know, what's provoked it?
Yes, the back.
You mean in this arena or elsewhere?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I took over the chairmanship, I had a very different agenda that I wanted to work: affordable housing, consumer protection, mass transit. And, of course, then we got hit by 9/11. We had to worry on the money laundering issue. And then, of course, at Enron, and then that dominated the committee's work for almost 9 months. I think it's very important that the SEC and the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board be given the opportunity to put into place the framework that's contained in the legislation and to get it up and working. And then that'll give us a chance to see how its application actually gets carried out. There are people coming in all the time. They want to undo various aspects of it. I don't think that's advisable, and so we're trying to get this framework fully into place and fully applicable. We've gotten a lot of pressure from overseas, but that now is diminishing, I think, because they've been able to work out some convergence. There are other areas the Commission is now looking at that, of course, we've held hearings on. We're watching very closely. I mean, the SEC has a major agenda before it now involving the mutual fund industry. Chairman Donaldson, in his testimony, said to, in effect, give us a chance to try to deal with this through the regulatory structure, and we're watching that very closely because there are obviously things that need to be done, but the Commission has promulgated a number of rules which are now going through their hearing process. I must say to the SEC, in my opinion, has a very good process for trying to reach final regulations. I mean, people have an opportunity to be heard. They propose regulations. They may re-propose regulations. So they work through a careful process that gives everyone a chance to be heard and to make their comments. And many of these issues are, of course, highly technical and very complex. So you need the expertise of the Commission staff working at these problems in order to try to work through the solutions. Yeah.
Do you think it would be beneficial to have more CPAs who
Well, first of all, I think CPAs are, I mean, Stanley Sporkin is a CPA, I hasten to observe. Who gets in the Congress is determined by, what the people say about it. You don't have a criterion for, in that sense, for coming. I do think that just generally speaking, anything we can do to heighten the level of competence and professionalism in any area of our public policy is a desirable thing. And in fact, I sometimes get concerned because I think in some respects there's been a diminution of competence rather than an enhancement. One of the things I was always struck by with respect to Roosevelt's New Deal, although of course, you have a nation that's 25% unemployed, so, I mean, where are people gonna go for jobs, but it was the extraordinary competence of the people who came into government and helped to implement many of the New Deal policies. I mean, I've always, of course, regarded public service as a very high calling, and I'm not sure we're succeeding nowadays in attracting from our colleges and universities the very best. I think we're getting good people. But I don't sense there's quite this, and I spend time on college campuses talking about this very subject. Yeah, Don?
This is a very general question. I'll try to make it specific enough so you can respond to it.
Well, that's why I can answer. Yeah. You know the difference between a generalist and a specialist? I have to share this with you. I just heard it the other day. A generalist learns more and more about less and less until eventually the generalist knows... A generalist learns less... I get it confused. A generalist learns less and less about more and more until eventually the generalist knows nothing about everything. The specialist learns more and more about less and less until eventually the specialist knows everything about nothing. So, what's your question?
I don't know which one of those I represent. We live in an era where deregulation is almost the definition of good government. I think Sarbanes-Oxley is perhaps almost nearly unique, if not genuinely unique, in terms of new regulatory initiatives over the last several years. I've always felt that government had a responsibility to regulate the various centers of power in society. And as someone who deals with this kind of activity every day, do you think that the Congress is committed to continuing deregulation of our environment, our health care, our economy, to the point where we beg for more crises like we had in the corporate sector in the early part of this decade?
Quite possibly. I think what's happened is a couple of things. First of all, a small truth that government cannot do everything was transformed into a big falsehood that government couldn't do anything. That's one of the things that's happened, I think, in the thinking of the country. So you took a fairly self-evident proposition that the government can't do everything, and then that was transformed into saying that the government couldn't do anything. Secondly, more and more people are getting elected who are highly ideological. They know what they think before they come, and then they don't want to be confused by the facts. Well, this is a real problem. I mean, I was taught that you confront a problem. You obviously have certain values that you bring to the problem. That's what the democratic system is all about. But not to the extent that you have such a rigid position that you're unwilling to take in the facts and subject them to a rigorous analysis in order to come up with workable solutions to the problem. But you know, now a lot of it is a shorthand. You have these kind of rubrics that are you're referred to, and if you seem to be running counter to that, why then you can't have any discussion or any moving forward. And I think the country is very ill served by that kind of attitude. So I don't think we're really coming to grips. And finally, in my own view about the workings of the markets, is that if you don't have it within some framework, regulatory framework, that deals with the corner cutters and the sharp operators who are prepared to abuse the workings of the system in order to make short-term gains, you're going to drag people downwards towards the lowest denominator. I've had accountants come to me and thank me for this legislation. And the story they tell is, well, you know, they were under a lot of pressure from a client to approve a certain off-balance arrangement or something of that sort, and they refused to do it, saying, and then the client says, well, my competitor down the street is doing it, and his accountant, his auditor, has approved it. Well, of course, the implicit message, not so implicit, is if you don't approve it, I may go find myself another auditor. So these people feel under tremendous pressure to go to the lowest denominator. One of the tragedies of the demise of Arthur Andersen was that Andersen himself, who founded the firm, and Leon Spejcik, who succeeded him, were known for their rectitude. I mean, they took this Supreme Court quote that I gave you about the role of the auditor. After all, the law requires public companies to have a certified financial statement. If they don't have it, they can't be listed on an exchange. So it gives a tremendous authority to the public accountants, and they were known in their day for saying to companies, well, if you're going to engage in that practice, we're not going to sign your financial statement. And you're going to end up having to come off the market listing. And they would stick to it. And they were known for that kind of rigor. Well, we've lost a great deal of that. In fact, we've even had instances in which the auditors were joining in joint ventures with a company they were auditing. It's a complete departure. And this management stuff, we had a bank out in Illinois that failed. Their auditors, as management consultants, established the financial systems by which the bank valued its assets. The bank ran into difficulty, the FDIC finally had to move in, because the residuals on their real estate holdings were overvalued. The value had been approved by the auditors, but the values had been established by the financial system which the auditors had put in place as management consultants. Well, you can't have the system. I mean, you don't have the checks and balances and the independence of judgment that's important to make the system work in those circumstances. But I think we face a challenge. On this legislation, you know, the damage was so great that we were able to move it through. We brought it out of committee on a 17-4 vote, and 3 days later, WorldCom went belly up, and of course that gave a tremendous boost to moving the legislation through the Congress, because I knew at the time that the forces that couldn't beat us in the committee were laying in wait to beat us in the conference committee, which often happens in the dead of night, and we know that's where a lot of mischief is done, but by the time we got there, there was too much of a momentum behind it.
Good. Thank you, Senator Zarbanes. And I must say, for full disclosure, in the spirit of this talk, that we have another director here, Janet Howard, who I want to recognize as well. Janet, nice to have you here. Senator Zarbanes, thank you not only for this crystal clear presentation of the initiative that you took, but also for the leadership that you provided in the direction, I think, that is the spirit of Don Fowler's question. And there will be other judgments made about those directions in the months ahead. Thank you all for coming.